What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Ruby wants more than I can give her, but that's how children are. They expect you to fix all things, figure out all things, and love them always. Sometimes you can't do any of that. Sometimes you barely love yourself or not at all. Sometimes you barely drag yourself out of bed and function in a world that is neither a clue nor care that you've abandoned the dreams you had for yourself. Instead, you're raised a child who loves you but resents you because of the mistakes you made. I'm stitched together by the lies I tell myself and the lies people want to believe about me. This is G.P. Gottlieb, and today I'm talking to Catherine Adele West, author of Saving Ruby King, a beautifully written debut novel about friendship, love, spirituality, intergenerational trauma, racial injustice, and loss. Set in Chicago's gritty far south side, West's characters each get a voice, including that of the Calvary Hope Church, around which much of the action takes place. Ruby King knows that her father is abusive, and so does everyone else in the community, but nobody seems able to do anything about it. Then her mother is murdered. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Galia. Really appreciate it.
So how'd you come to write Saving Ruby King?
Well, Saving Ruby King was, it started off as a short story, and it was just going to kind of be a way for me to understand the relationship that I had with my dad. It's loving, but it's kind of complicated, and how the church played a role in it. And I was talking to a friend at a wedding, and she said, you know what, that would be a great book. And I'm thinking like, oh, yeah. Book. I can write a book. I got 2 degrees in journalism. How hard can it be? Turns out it's like so freaking hard to write a book. Duh. But I pushed through. It took me a few years. But a short story morphed into, you know, a literary fiction book with a little bit of mystery, you know, a lot of, you know, culture and just like a book about, you know, kind of my great love for Chicago. And its people. I'm so happy that I was able to kind of persevere and write this book. It's so well received. I'm just completely astounded.
I am so happy too, because I loved it. And we share our love of Chicago. Specifically, you talk about Bronzeville, about which you write, quote, that it's a whole black world within a city, a world with only our people who arrived barely a century ago in innumerable droves during the Great Migration, living in cramped tenements with tenuous hope of more freedom than what was doled out down south. So my question is, do you feel like this is a distinctly Chicago story?
I feel like it's a distinctly human story. It just takes place in the wonderful, magnificent city of Chicago. My love for Chicago definitely shines through in the book, but Saving Ruby King is a book of very universal in themes, you know, love, forgiveness, family, spirit. So I just felt that that was a way for me to let people know where I come from. But at the same time, you know, just in and of themselves are universal. But, you know, I definitely show love to the city where I was born and raised.
Mm-hmm. Calvary Baptist Church has a voice in your story. It watches events unfold, notices the color of paint chosen. What binds everyone to Calvary Baptist Church?
Actually, it's called Calvary Hope Christian.
Christian.
Yeah. So the thing is, when it comes to a lot of African-American churches, we have really, I feel we have dramatic things. But the one thing that binds church or binds all of these is the church. It's the community of the church and people that they've known for Layla, like since she was born, for Jackson, since he was born, for Lebanon, since he was born. It's how I grew up. So a lot of the from my church, I've known essentially all my life. And I mean, even if you grow up and you go away, or they grow up and they move away, like these are people you're still gonna like invite to your wedding. These people show up to like your funeral. Like, it's just the church, the Black church in particular, is just a way that we, or African Americans, come together and act. And I wanted to definitely show that Calvary Hope Church. I honestly think that it, the aspect of religion in the book, I think that when some people see church or Calvary Hope Church, or, you know, kind of the mentions of God, they kind of think like, oh, this is about like converting. And it's just like, no, this is about a place, not necessarily about converting anybody. Not that, it's about how the church has a not necessarily the spiritual world that God may play in somebody's life.
So, Catherine, you write that Black people always seem to go by nicknames. What's your nickname? Do you have one?
Actually, I have many. It really depends on who you ask. Normally, it's just Kathy. C-A-T-H-Y, super simple. That's essentially how I'm known, what I have friends call me. But the other nicknames, you are never going to know, because those are personal and those are familial. And if anybody else called me by that name, they might get a stern talking to by me. But normally just my nickname is Kathy or Kat, never Kate. I am not a Kate. Don't ever, ever call me Kate. I will not answer you.
Okay. Like,
that's just not what you do. And that's not who I am. But Kathy, okay. Kathy is just like the general nickname that I go by.
So you write a lot, among the many subjects in this book, you write a lot about friendships. What do you see as the difference in friendships among women contrasted to friendships between men in your book, as in life?
Well, actually, believe it or not, the majority of my friends are men. So if you ever look at the acknowledgments of my book, like, I literally have a paragraph where I just thank all of my closest friends who happen to be guys. When it comes to relationships or friendships with men, I always feel like there is an emotional connection, but it's something you really, really got to delve deep into. Most of the time, it's jokes, it's ribbing, It's fun. It's like punches in the arms. Like, there is not a lot of, you know, I love you and you're like a brother to me. No, 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 no. That's not how it works. When it comes to female relationships, this is what I kind of had to learn, because I didn't have a lot of close female relationships literally until like a few years ago. When it comes to female relationships, they can be a lot more emotionally, we're a lot more deep. And when it comes to female friendships and Black female friendships in particular, we are ride or die for our own. Like, if you killed somebody, but you needed an alibi and we're friends, it's like, oh, well, all night. Like, I don't know what you say she did, sir, but she was with me, you know? So when it comes to kind of female relationships, I kind of feel like we wear our hearts on our sleeves a lot more. It's more emotional to me. There's just like this really, really deep, intense emotional connection to your female friends. And then when it comes to male friends, there's that bond and that there's that loyalty, but like the outward expressions of, you know, adoration and love, not so much, but that's honestly to be expected.
Yeah, that really comes through in the relationship of Ruby and in the relationship between Ruby and Layla. So Ruby recalls that Layla was always the smart one and she herself was the pretty one. And she felt like, in addition to external prejudice that as a Black woman, she was also a victim of internal prejudice. In the novel, you mention the burden of Black women. Can you expound on that?
Well, yeah, when I talk about the burden of Black women, it seems, and not it seems, this is just what it is. When it comes to the burden of Black women, we are marginalized. We are unprotected. We have to work 20 times as hard to get a quarter of what it is that we should be due. I kind of feel as if being a Black woman has made me stronger than I ever could have realized. It's one of those things where I have such a deep pride about who I am and where I came from. And unfortunately, that's not really celebrated to me in the media and literature, or rather not celebrated enough to me. Media and literature, just in general, you know, Black women, we can be maligned, ostracized, gaslighted. And just, you know, there are attempts to bring us to such a base or low level, but yet and still we rise above that every time and do so with such, you know, grace and perseverance, and power that it can literally scare other people. And then that's where you get that whole, you know, that unjustified, angry Black woman characterization, and our passion is always mistaken for anger when it's not that. But once again, it's just like a way to kind of align and ostracize and marginalize Black women when we are to be commended and celebrated for all of the contributions that we make, not just in literature, in art and entertainment and science and politics. I mean, just all across the board, and not just in the United States, all over the world. And I just feel that when it comes to Black women, that's not something that's done. And it's something that, you know, that needs to be rectified. And that's that burden that we carry.
Well said. What interested you about Ruby's relationship with her father?
Well, I wanted to kind of explore Black father-daughter relationships. One that was kind of somewhat healthy being Layla and Jackson's relationship, but it still had its challenges, and one that was just totally toxic and unhealthy. I think for me, the most interesting thing exploring the relationships were just one between Lebanon and me. I think were just the intersection of generational trauma and the secrets that cause generational trauma, and how that fully affected Lebanon and how he dealt with in terms of love or lack thereof. He was never really able to express it. As a matter of fact, Lebanon comes across as a very angry person, but there are reasons for why he's so angry, and why he harps that anger on others, either physically or verbally. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to explore Ruby and her reactions to that, because I just felt that there needed to be a realistic, somewhat realistic portrayal of what happens when that that chain of intergenerational trauma is not broken, and when it's left to up to the present generation to try and figure a way out of a very deep, dark phase of like psychological and heartbreaking secrets that haven't even been like, say, revealed to Lebanon. Like, he doesn't know all the reasons why he is then. And therefore Ruth doesn't know why her life is the way that it is in a lot of respects. So it was just really interesting to explore that relationship. And I had a really fun time doing it.
Mm. Layla wants to save Ruby. Is Ruby at all concerned about saving Layla?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that with Ruby, I think Ruby feels like Layla can pretty much take care of herself, that Layla has things together way more than she does. So Ruby loves Layla, and Ruby is there for Layla should anything, occur, like if Layla broke a leg or broke an arm or something, Ruby would be there, right? But Ruby just thinks, on the whole, I believe that Layla has everything together. So I don't think that Ruby looks at Layla in terms of her, of Layla needing to be saved. And truth be told, Ruby resents kind of feeling like Layla always save her, or somebody always needs to save her when Ruby is trying to perhaps find a way to save herself in some respect or turn her situation around.
Mm-hmm. What keeps Layla's father going?
Well, I think what keeps Jackson going is a combination of love and fear, just this deep, terrifying fear of if somebody really knew who he was, if they really found out the type of person he was or anything that he felt that he did, that he would just be lost, right? So I kind of feel that it's this kind of fear of who he was, but this love of his family and the desire to be the man that he's always wanted to be, but always feels like, he's fallen short of becoming. So it's like a lot, it's kind of alchemic mix of, love and fear and hope, desperation.
Mm-hmm. So these are all interconnected people. Now, going back to Ruby's father, Lebanon, he's visiting his dying mother in the hospital, and he says, quote, "We got to fight for everything we want, sometimes kill for it, everything. A nice suit, a friend, a good job after a 5-year bid for manslaughter." He was in prison for a few years. So the question is, does his difficult upbringing justify his attitude and behavior?
Well, I mean, it's kind of one of those things that, like, what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? So sometimes if you feel like you've got the short end of the stick, you feel justified in how you might react or lash out to certain things. I think part of it is because you have no other way to cope because you weren't taught how to cope with, anger or with sadness or with fear. And I think another part of it is you maybe want somebody to still stick with you and still save you. I think that's part of the reason Lebanon still stayed with Alice, that like he didn't leave. It was kind of like, no matter what I do, she's always there. You know what I mean? And it's one of those things where I believe that Lebanon isn't proud, or he doesn't take pride, or he doesn't relish and hurting people. But I think that for him, it seems like that's the only way he knows how to fully really just let go. I feel that if he knew his mother Sarah's story, like her full story, and everything that happened to her and how she became who she became, I think it would have saved him and Alice and Ruby a lot of heartache and grief and anger. And that's the thing about saving Ruby King. It's this unburdening, this kind of tale of the need to unburden secrets long buried and dark and deep in order to free not only self, but future generations.
Everybody needs saving in this book. Ruby needs it more, but can you talk a little more about Sarah, Lebanon's mother, Ruby's grandmother?
Yeah, so Sarah is, I describe her as kind of a toxic legend. Sarah is somebody on the surface who's cruel and bitter and angry. But if you got to know why she is the way she is, that feeling or that belief you had about her, who you think she is, it cracks. There are a lot of layers to Sarah, a lot of just crusty, rusty, just layers. But if you peel them back, you get to see the type of woman she was and she could have hoped to be. But, you know, life sucks sometimes and it's unfair. And for Sarah, it seems like her son as well, you know, Lebanon, that she always seems to get the short end of the stick. And it seems that sometimes there are people around her who are thriving more than she is. And she can't seem to reconcile why that is. And maybe if it's something in her that like draws all of these bad things. And if you try to ask yourself these questions and you try to find the answers, it probably drive you insane. So I think that with Sarah, the way that she copes or the way she would cope to drinking was, you know, alcoholism, unfortunately. And that's just like a whole nother issue, you know, like the circumstances and the results or the outcomes of addiction. Mm-hmm. But Sarah in and of herself, it's one of those things like, what could I have been had all of this not have happened?
She's such an important character, even though she's in the hospital dying of cancer. But everything, really, so much of it revolves around her, the whole story, right? She's really important. And Lebanon King asks himself, what are children supposed to forgive their parents for the horrible things they've done? What's your answer to that question?
My answer to that question is that there's no easy answer, you know? Mm-hmm. I can only answer for myself. You know, Galit, I don't know what, you know, say your parents have done to you. Like, you can answer that question for yourself and your parents. I can only answer that question for myself and my parents. But I will say that in terms of forgiveness and the need to do so, more oftentimes than not, it's better for you to it's better to forgive. That doesn't mean that you were dismissing anything your parent has done to you, good, bad, ugly, horrific, unspeakable. Nobody is saying that. I'm definitely not saying that. But like in terms of the need to forgive, it's just kind of a reconciling of knowing this was something that had nothing to do with me, but because of circumstances, these are how these things played out. So I'm just going to make, I'm going to make the choice to forgive my parent while at the same time paying, you know, recognizing what was done to me was not at all okay, but it made me a stronger person. It made me a better person. It helped me to learn this particular lesson. That's how I tend to look at it in terms of me forgiving my parents for whatever wrongs I feel they've done to me.
Do you think Ruby forgives her parents ultimately?
I think that Ruby can learn to do it, but that it's up to her. That's a journey that she's going to have to go through on her own. And, you know, we all hope for a better ending for ourselves. But that's something Ruby's going to have to kind of determine if she's going to be able to, you know, forgive her father for being abusive and forgive her mom for staying with him. But ultimately, the way that you do that is kind of explore who you are and how it is those circumstances have affected and shaped you and make the determination from there for whether or not you're going to be able to, you know, forgive your parents. So I'll just say that that's completely up to her.
Okay. You mentioned the Chicago Bee and the Chicago Defender. Can you talk a bit about Black-owned newspapers in Chicago? What happened to them? What's going on now?
Well, I'm really not an expert, but what I can say generally is that African-American newspapers, especially during the turn of the century, the early 20th century, and even now, there are ways for African-Americans to find out what's going on in their communities, because this was not talked about in white-owned newspapers, right? They didn't care about African-Americans, our issues, our struggles. There was very real and needed information in all of these newspapers. There were different ones. I think there was one called the Amsterdam. We had the Chicago Bee. That went out of business. We have Chicago Defender. And once again, it was just like a way for African-Americans to find out what's going on with them and their lives. And truth be told, there is a book called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. It's a fantastic book about the Great Migration.
It's a wonderful book.
So good. And she was talking about the Chicago Defender and how the Chicago Defender, I believe, would have to be secretly shipped down south. And that's how, like, that's the reason, like, a lot of people would come up north. They would read, like, these Black-owned newspapers and be like, oh, in the north, there are, like, all of these opportunities that we don't have here. But there was just so much more information that was, you know, given in African-American papers on civil rights, on a lot of different subjects and things. But once again, I'm no expert. I would, you know, you'd have to go to an African-American historian who knows way more than I could ever know.
So, is there one in Chicago, though? Is there one right now?
I believe the Chicago Defender is still in play.
Okay. Okay.
The Chicago Bee went out of business, like, according to my research, Chicago Bee went out of business. It used to hold a cosmetics factory, the building did, and now it's a library. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's in Bronzeville.
Okay. Layla, I love Layla. She says that the easiest thing when confronted with evil is to do nothing, and that all of them, everyone in the book, they were all guilty of it. Do you agree with that?
I agree with it in parts. Layla has a very black and white view of things. It mirrors my own. I'm not a gray person. You know, it's either this or it's that. You know, there's very few, for me, gray areas. You know, you're right or you're wrong. It's up, you're down. It's left, you're right. So Layla's like, we did nothing, and this is what's happened. I think that if she looked or if she knew about, say, her grandma Violet's story and Naomi's story and Sarah's story, she would see that they did what they could for the times in which they found themselves. You know, Ruby does what she can for the situation in which she finds herself. Layla, in her own way, tries to do what she can, but is it enough? Hell no, it's not. It's not enough. And that's where Layla has a hard time reconciling why her dad acts or why he reacts to Lebanon the way that he reacts. And therefore, kind of subconsciously taking her cue from him, she doesn't react in the way that she feels like she needs to. So I kind of feel that, you know, if Layla were to know the whole history, she would see that it's more complicated than just doing nothing.
This was a wonderful read. I sat down and didn't get up till I finished because it was a page turn. It was a Kindle page turner. So I'm wondering, can I look forward to another book soon? What are you working on now?
Oh, well, I'm actually working on a prequel to Saving Ruby King that follows Sarah King's years, her few years in Memphis, and what happens that kind of solidifies this kind of move from, you know, possible old Sarah to kind of the toxic legend we know and and love and sometimes loathe in Saving Ruby King. So I am kind of working out the details on that, and hopefully it gets, you know, picked up and acquired, and I can continue Saving Ruby King saga.
And then they can make a movie out of it.
You know what?
Movie.
That's the hope. That is the hope. I mean, honestly, with everything that goes on, a limited TV series would probably be best, because I don't know if you can fit all of this into 2 hours. But let's just cross our fingers and toes that somebody feels similarly.
Okay. I'm going to cross my fingers for you, too. This was so lovely. I wish you the best. Thank you so much for joining me today, Catherine.
Galit, thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it, and I love the questions. This was so much fun.